Just a couple of weeks ago, President Biden joined the UAW picket line. And a week later, Sean Fain, UAW's president, gave a defiant speech, harshly criticizing car company executives while wearing a t-shirt emblazoned with these words, "Eat the rich."
The UAW of today, under the leadership of Sean Fain, it tore a page from Walter Reuther's book. They have a more militant view. I would say it's quasi-socialistic. It's not blatantly socialistic, but it's the recognition that workers are entitled to their rightful share of profits. By cars, it goes back to a notion that Henry Ford had that, he wanted to produce a car that workers could buy. What many of the auto workers are saying today is that they're producing cars they can't afford to buy. Among the Detroit Three, their hourly labor costs were over $72 an hour. Mm-hmm. In the foreign transplants, they were $45.
Wow, that's a big difference.
And so the costs became prohibitive. And I think, many people say that, well, now he can't get involved because he's already shown he's biased. But I think
it may
just be the other way around, that since he's demonstrated his support from the union, and if the union's holding out for something that is, let's say, hypothetically not realistic, and the president wants this strike stopped for the benefit of the economy, he could go in and say, look, I support you, but now's the time to call this to a halt. And, many people begin to liken it to the Teamsters, but I would say that the Teamsters, just to put the Teamsters in comparison to the UAW in terms of their scandals, the Teamsters was mob infested. UAW was not.
Did you know that the UAW had a reputation for being a union of high integrity and for being innovative in its collective bargaining and its focus on getting as much as it could for its membership? But then something unfortunate happened. UAW executives were embroiled in a grand corruption scandal, which gave Sean Fain and his supporters, who, as my guest explains, were really an insurgent group, the opportunity to defeat UAW's incumbent president by a thin margin in a runoff election. Shortly after his election victory in March of this year, Mr. Fain told autoworkers that he was fed up with the status quo. And here we are now with a strike that began in mid-September. Hey there, news peelers. Today is October 13, 2023. And this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink, or both, and let's get into it. Stick with it. You deserve the significant raise you need and other benefits. These words were spoken by the President of the United States, Mr. Joe Biden, at the UAW picket line at a General Motors customer care center. UAW's president, Mr. Fain, called this a historic moment. And of course it was, because never before has a sitting American president joined a labor union's strike. UAW workers are asking for a 40% pay raise. The president believes that, one, they deserve it, and two, they should be able to get it through bargaining. This probably comes as no surprise to you, since Mr. Biden has proclaimed himself as the most pro-union president in history. But another president, a former one, also displayed his staunch support for unions. Following Mr. Biden's visit, Mr. Trump also visited Detroit. Mr. Trump blames the Biden administration's and the Democrats' electric vehicle policies as the root cause of the challenges UAW workers are now facing. Not to be overlooked when it comes to anything related to cars, Mr. Elon Musk jumped into the fray by stating that the UAW's demand of a 40% pay raise and a 32-hour work week will quickly bankrupt the Big Three. So, this strike is historic for three different reasons. First, President Biden's personal visit. Second, because it is the first time the union has struck against the Big Three at the same time. And third, because strikes have been called only at select locations. So Mr. Fain has kept most of UAW's 146,000 workers on the job. This serves two purposes. It leaves the companies guessing as to which plants may have UAW walk out next. Also, by keeping most UAW members on the job, the union conserves its $825 million fund reserved for paying the striking workers at about $500 a week. To better understand UAW's history and the history of how unions negotiate deals with auto companies, I spoke with Dr. Marek Masters, who is a professor of business in the Department of Management and Information Systems at Wayne State University, where he has served as director of labor at Wayne, which included the Doug A. Fraser Center for Workplace Issues and chair of the Departments of Accounting and Finance. Dr. Masters' research and teaching interests are in negotiations and conflict resolution, unions, business and labor political action, federal sector labor management relations, human resource management and employee relations, workplace privacy, and workplace violence. He has published more than 100 articles on these subjects, as well as the following books: The UAW, An Iconic Union Falls in Scandal. This is an interesting book. In fact, interesting is an understatement. It's a fascinating book that tells the unbelievable stories of villas in Palm Springs and vacations in Italy, all bought and paid for on the union's dime. And you bet that we discuss it in this episode. In this episode, we also talk about another book titled Trade Union Finance: How Labor Organizations Raise and Spend Money. This book is of personal interest to me because I used to be a union member and I often wondered whatever happens to the fees I pay to my union. To learn more about Dr. Masters, you can visit his academic homepage, the link for which is provided in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Dr. Masters and I peel the history behind this news.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Dr. Masters, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me. Let's begin our talk with some basics here. When was the UAW founded?
It was founded in the mid-1930s, although there were efforts to form unions among auto workers before that. But officially, its first constitutional convention was held in 1936, and it had a very turbulent beginning in which it went through several gyrations, first affiliating with the AFL-CIO, then the CIO, and going through a period of intense factionalism in which there were essentially competing groups vying almost violently for power within the UAW until the late...
Violently? Oh, wow. Okay.
Until almost the late 1940s when Walter Reuther... I mean by violently, they were very heated exchanges. There were parties groups that had very profound differences with each other. There were socialist groups, there were communist groups, there were more craft union oriented types of groups within the struggle. But it took a while to sort out, and all this was coterminous when the union was fighting with the companies for recognition.
And all of this, when you say 1936, this is in the later years, 6-7 years into the Great Depression, and FDR is the president. Yeah. Did that inform and guide any of their activities?
Oh, certainly it did. I think, as a result of the Great Depression and Roosevelt's election, you had a turnaround in public policy towards unions. Yeah. And there were laws enacted which favored the organizing of unions. And that really, I think, gave momentum to the labor movement, which had begun already in response to the Great Recession and fear that, workers were really being left behind and neglected, and their wages had gone down. Employment levels were still very low, relatively speaking, at that time. And people were struggling to make ends meet in a very basic sense. And, as an aside, I remember very much my grandparents who lived through the Great Depression talking about the hardship that they went through and how they lost their jobs and how they had to go live with their parents and survive by that way, which was a less than ideal circumstances for newlyweds at that time. But it was rendered a lot of hardship on people. And so they struggled. And it really wasn't until World War II and the mobilization of the economy that we fully recovered from the Great Depression.
Did your grandparents work in the auto industry by any chance?
No. My grandfather was a baseball player, a minor league baseball player.
Oh, that's great.
At odds and ends to make ends meet at that point in time. And then he couldn't get a job during the Depression years. And my grandmother was for that generation, she was college educated.
Oh, wow. And wow, that's a big deal.
She did not go to work right away. But later on, toward the very end of the Depression, she got a job teaching in a school district and was able to make ends by that. My grandfather got a job as a clerk for the railroad industry, the Illinois Central. And that job, I'll tell you, he was so proud of that job. When he retired, he got free rides for the rest of his life.
Oh, wonderful.
Did
you ever go on those free rides?
I never got to go with him on it, but he used to come and visit us. He lived in Illinois. We lived then in Pennsylvania, and he used to take the train to Carbondale, Illinois, to Altoona, Pennsylvania.
Wonderful. That's a great story and a nice digression. Let's get back to UAW, and you intrigue me by this timeline, Dr. Masters. The Constitution, their internal Constitution was in 1936, and it took way into the 40s for them to fully materialize into a union as we know it. Did World War II delay any of this activity? Like, the sense of patriotism, don't unionize, all efforts go towards the war.
Well, I don't think it delayed union activity. I think what it did is refocus it.
Refocused it, okay.
The UAW grew dramatically after they won recognition from General Motors and Ford Motor Company. And so before actually the start of our involvement in World War II, they had grown to a significant size, about maybe 500,000 members from about 30,000 when they originally formed, as a collection of local unions in the mid-1930s. They were formed really by aggregating these local unions together in under one umbrella. And that's one of the reasons why they had so many competing different factions, because they were pre-existing to the formation of the union.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
But during World War II, you know, there were all kinds of war stabilization boards, which really put a stop to strikes for the war effort. But the union benefited because, you know, everybody's heard the phrase now, the arsenal of democracy. They were really the arsenal of democracy. And so the auto companies really became the producers for the war machine, if you will. And the employment that resulted from that, the massive government contracts that they received and the jobs that were produced as a result of that led to the growth in the United Auto Workers. And at the end of World War II, there were pent-up frustrations because of wage price controls and rationing. Workers wanted to catch up with their wages. And there was also concern during the transition, the demilitarization period in which so many people were, you know, not producing the war machine anymore and coming back from military service, going back into the civilian workforce. They had to find a place for them. And there was a period of really, I think, intensive strike activity. And the UAW had a major strike in the 1945-1946 region, in which it demanded 30% wage hikes. And it was during that time period, I would think from the mid-1940s through the mid-1970s, that the UAW's relationship with the auto companies, I would characterize it as being predictably adversarial.
Predictably adversarial. Oh, interesting.
That they struck every year, one of the major auto companies, between 1950 and 1976.
1950 to 1976? That's a lot of striking.
Every 3 years. And that's just the where they would strike one. In 1 year, in 1955, they struck two at the same time. But one of them was only for one day. But Reuther established in the early 50s this idea of targeting a company and then trying to negotiate a contract with that company as a basis for taking to the other two to establish a pattern in the industry.
This is really fascinating. One strike a year almost from 1950 to 1976, in one case, two strikes. For us to talk about this would take hours and hours, a couple of more podcasts. Yeah. What I'm interested in, just generally speaking, do you think UAW's platform has drastically changed since this period? And it's kind of a tough question because the period itself stretches over 30 years. So is this the same UAW now?
Well, let me pinpoint a time period during that era that I think resembles where we are now. And I think actually the UAW of today, under the leadership of Sean Fain, which really led an insurgent group to the helm in the recent elections that were held due to the scandal, it tore a page from Walter Reuther's book. And that isn't a criticism. That's just, I think they realized that it was a wonderful page to replicate and that they have a more militant view. I would say it's quasi-socialistic. It's not blatantly socialistic, but it's the recognition that workers are entitled to their rightful share of profits. And Walter Reuther had an interesting way of phrasing it, I thought was, he said that the challenge before labor and business is to find a way to share our equities between labor, business, that is the shareholders and customers in the abundance of corporations.
In the abundance of corporations, okay.
Yeah. And that meant more than just necessarily their profits, also their revenues and their infrastructure, if you will. But I think that it's a realization that, you know, Ruther said that they shouldn't have to depend on the muscle of collective bargaining to get their fair share. But that was an unfortunate reality.
How else would they do it if they didn't?
I think you were hoping for some sort of, if not government mandate or policy that would encourage that.
I see.
Perhaps a progressive industrial policy, but more likely some sort of compact between the companies and the unions that would say labor's entitled to a certain share and that we ought to be willing to treat them like we do other equity partners.
So was this, you said you're going to point us to an earlier period in UAW's history.
This was the period in the, I would say, between really 1950 and 1960 when Walter Ruther ran the UAW, in which he made this case in which he was able to secure the contracts that got the benefits that were precedent setting in American labor to provide for pensions, to provide for health care, to provide for cost of living allowances and other things, and to also tie wage increases to productivity increases. Ruther didn't really believe that you got anything unless you gave something. And he knew that they wanted to be able to give the companies reason to raise their prices so that they could generate more profits. And he felt that that was being more productive as workers.
Raise prices, more revenue, more to share.
They could produce more for less money. And therefore, they didn't have to pass the increase of wages on fully, but they could pass some of them on and still be able to sell their cars because workers' standard of living were going up as a result of the wage increases. And they were able to buy cars. It goes back to a notion that Henry Ford had that, he wanted to produce a car that workers could buy. What many of the auto workers are saying today is that they're producing cars they can't afford to buy.
Interesting, which is different than what Henry Ford had suggested. Now, going back to this period, 1950 to 61, while Walter Ruther and then also other strikes that you were talking about, again, without getting into each one of them individually, I'm just wondering, what compels the UAW's leadership to call a strike? It's a big deal. Is it just being at loggerheads? Is it some of the stuff that you were sharing, internal strife, like factional issues within? Is it the political climate?
I would say that it boiled down to that they felt the continual need to keep the pressure on the companies, that if they didn't pressure the companies continually, that they would not give them what they felt they could get and what they were capable of giving. And that therefore they knew that one of the ways they could clearly get their attention was by striking them. And that was probably the quickest way they could get to getting what they wanted. And otherwise, they were going to be complacent and lackadaisical, and you couldn't force them into sharing their wealth, so to speak. It's also important to remember during this time period, the dominant position that the Detroit Three, the major auto companies, had. They monopolized the market, literally speaking. In 1965, the big three, so to speak, Ford, GM, and Chrysler, they controlled over 90% of the market share of vehicle sales in the U.S.
Wow.
Now it's just a little bit over 40%.
So back then, there was less pressure for them.
Yeah, they were literally an oligopoly, and they could pass along price increases. I won't say they colluded, but it didn't take much rocket science to figure out what everybody else is doing when there are only three of you. Yeah. And you basically produce the same product and the same costs. You buy the same materials from the same suppliers, and you know how to play the game. But I think that that was the reality that they were in. And they got into a ritualistic pattern. And also, I think it's important to remember there were lots of strikes during this time period in the broader transportation equipment industry, agricultural equipment, aerospace equipment, trucking, those kinds of things. There were lots of strikes in that broader industry. And there were a fair number of not only authorized strikes, that is, those sanctioned by the union, but wildcat strikes in which locals went out on strike. And when I'm talking, when I recounted that incidence of strikes every 3 years, I am not including the number of local strikes, because it's important to remember when the UAW negotiates its contracts, it's now every 4 years. It also is negotiating all its local contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So under each of these companies, it has a number of local agreements which deal with things such as plant conditions, job classifications, scheduling at the plants, those kinds of things. They have their own agreements on those terms, but they don't tie their local agreements to their national agreement.
Even the terms of local agreements may be different?
Well, you don't have to approve them all at once. So, for example, like if you're in the Teamsters, when they negotiate their national agreement, like they did recently with UPS, they also will negotiate local agreements. But for their national agreement to take effect, all their local agreements have to be negotiated and approved as well. But okay. You don't have to have that in the auto industry. So what would often happen is that you would have the national agreement being reached, but many locals not being able to reach agreement, and there being strike at the local levels. So there were strikes at the local levels. And then there was a period of time in which it was not uncommon for there to be lots of what we call wildcat or illegal strikes. They're unauthorized by the union, but a group of people at a local level just decide for whatever reason they're going out on strike, and that can be very disruptive.
And when you say illegal per the union's rules, right?
Per the National Labor Relations Act.
Yeah.
And also, they're not sanctioned by the union. The union doesn't condone wildcat strikes. It only wants strikes to occur with their approval. So if you're a local union, you want to go out on strike in the UAW, you have to get the approval of the national union.
I see. Is it my perception, or did strikes and union heft in the automobile industry sort of wane, or perhaps not be in the news media for several decades?
Dramatically.
Dramatically. Okay, so I'm not misperceiving.
Yes, yeah. So after 1976, you had a strike in 1983. Then you had a strike in 2007 and 2019. These are national strikes.
Oh, these are far fewer than before.
Yes, and then you had over a period of, I'd say, 30 years, the past 30 years, you've had maybe 50 strikes at the local and national level against GM and Chrysler. You haven't had any against Ford.
I see. But it surely is less, doesn't dominate the news as much as I used to.
No. It strike activity in the U.S. in general, across all industries, manufacturing, auto manufacturing, and everything but the public sector, has fallen precipitously. So up until, even this year, when there's all the talk about these plentiful strikes, there have only been 18 new strikes involving a little bit over 300,000 workers. And that's of a workforce of more than 160 million.
Wow. Wow, that is fewer. All right. Well, let's take a break here, and we'll be back to talk about union scandals and financing. Last year, when Amazon and Starbucks workers went on a strike, and when it looked like employees at Trader Joe's and Microsoft may also organize and walk out, I spoke with Dr. Kate Bruffenbrenner about the history of labor unions in the United States. She shared the history of unions in the service industries, such as healthcare and hospitality, and told me how the history of America's labor unions is tightly intertwined with the history of immigration. And she enlightened me about a point I hadn't appreciated before, that unions also fight to protect the climate. Dr. Bruffenbrenner is the Director of Labor Education Research at ILR School and the Industrial and Labor Relations School of Cornell University. She's also a senior lecturer at the ILR School and the co-director of the Worker Empowerment Research Project. I've dropped a link to my conversation with Dr. Bruffenbrenner, which was in Season 2, Episode 23. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Masters. Dr. Masters, in the previous segment, we were talking about UAW's current strike, and one of the terms that you mentioned in passing was scandal. And, you know, there are many movies going back to the 1930s and reports. Some of them are dramatized. Some of them are hyperbolized about union scandals and corruption. Let's get the inside story. I want to talk about your book, The UAW, An Iconic Union Falls in Scandal. What is this book about?
Well, it's about the scandal that plagued the union for about a decade that involved basically personal greed, union leaders and company executives taking money from the joint training centers. And these training centers were formed between the UAW and the Detroit Three in the 1980s to train workers to improve productivity and to improve quality. And they really morphed, I think, into, with all the good intentions, social welfare organizations as well as training organizations. And these joint training centers funds were managed jointly by the company and the union, but without really sufficient prudent oversight and financial controls in most cases. So it led to a situation in where some greedy hands saw an opportunity to take advantage of these funds, and it began initially at Chrysler in a little before 2010, in which the labor relations executives were under pressure from the top management of Chrysler, Fiat Chrysler at the time. To really buy the union's complicity in labor relations.
And I'm sorry, I didn't follow that. To buy the union's complicity?
To buy the union's complicity in labor relations, to go along with what the company needed in collective bargaining, to not pursue too many grievances, to really sort of be a little bit complacent
in
their approach. Okay. And so they turned their joint training centers, and these training centers could have tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars at one point in time. I think GM's at one point in time in the 90s had over $700 million in its joint training center. And it was funded by the companies based on the number of hours worked by the workers. And it was basically the top management of Chrysler decided that they were going to let the union officials use these joint training centers as their personal bank accounts.
So all the funds were not used for training? They pocketed it personally?
They would take trips to Italy. They would buy expensive clothes. They would pay down the mortgage on their house. They would take funds and donate them to their favorite charities, which they ran and used to benefit themselves directly or indirectly. So there was a lot of money that they directly or indirectly took to advantage themselves. And then I got to the point at Chrysler, at least, that the company executives, some of them, one in particular, decided, this is such a good deal, I'm going to take some of that money myself. And so he started charging the joint training centers for what he did was he remodeled his house and he bought a Lamborghini about $400,000 and had a personalized license plate put on it and did other things, paid for expensive cigars, expensive liquor. And then in two other parts of the union, at General Motors, they use their training funds to, in kickback schemes, to give money to the top ranks of the union leadership that handled General Motors affairs. And then at the International, they had a regional director with the International president, a couple International presidents, decided that they were going to use their own treasury money to finance lavish lifestyles. And so they spent months during the hard, cruel winter months in Detroit. They would spend them in Palm Springs living in villas.
Oh, my God. Who is supervising this, Dr. Masters? What's happening here?
Well, I think nobody was. But eventually, I think what ended up happening was that, some of these bills that they had to get paid, they were buying things from vendors. And they were using fake accounts to do this. They thought they could get through it that way. But I think some of the accountants at the UAW turned them in and to the federal prosecutors and said, you should come and look at what's going on here. And they started around 2015 an investigation. And it was not until 2017 that it was first reported in the media that this scandal had been going on and it was being investigated. And then things just mushroomed from 2017, July, until the latter part of 2019, in which they were able to, during this period, prosecute successfully several wrongdoers, forced the resignation of an international president, and then ultimately forced his imprisonment and forced the imprisonment of his predecessor, who had also partook of this largesse.
From what it sounds like, the pilfered funds were mostly from the auto companies that were put into this quote-unquote joint venture, right?
That's where joint training centers, most of the funds were pilfered from the joint training centers.
And those funds came from the auto companies, not so much the union dues.
Yeah.
I used to be, many, many years ago, I used to be a union member myself, and I paid dues. It's not like I had a choice. You just start working for a company, and you're a union member. And I always wondered, as a young, much younger man, what happened to my dues? Like, by the way, that was Teamsters, so not UAW, a whole different ball of wax over there. You have a book titled Trade Union Finance, How Labor Organizations Raise and Spend Money. So answer my question, please. What happened to all my dues? How do unions make money? Like someone's working, they got to have a salary as a union boss.
They raise money from two basic sources. They raise money from dues and other taxes imposed on members. Some of them have assessments, that initial assessments, initial fees you pay to join.
Like an interview process that you pay for? Is that something?
No, it's just an initiation fee.
Oh, I see.
Like you join and you pay $100. For some unions, that can be a pretty big fee.
Okay. How big of a fee can it get?
For if you're in the airline pilots union, or if you're in the entertainment industry or in the sports industry, those initiation fees can be pretty heavy. But if you're in most unions, they're relatively modest, although they're a little bit bigger in the construction industry because you pay for training and all those kinds of things when you first get in. But I think that you pay dues or per capita taxes, which amount to basically the same thing. And then they raise money from various services that they provide. Some of them sell insurance. Some of them sell, you know, credit cards. Some of them, have property that they manage or rent, all those kinds of things. Generate business income.
So when you say insurance and credit cards, are these sort of credit cards and insurance that are catered for the union members themselves?
Yes. Yeah, you can get a credit card and you might get a discount. You can get a discount for legal insurance. You can get a discount for supplemental health insurance. You can get a discount for other types of insurance that you might want to buy that they offer. So that they provide those kinds of benefits, if you will, to joining that are exclusively the prerogative of their members. They're not available to people who aren't members.
Okay. I want to make sure that the following two are not part and parcel of these finances. There's no government money that is subsidizing unions, is there?
Well, they can get grant money for training.
Okay. And that's a special purpose, right?
Yeah, that most government grants are for a special purpose. You don't get a blank check.
Yeah.
They can also get grants and donations from nonprofit organizations. Mm-hmm. And sometimes these will fund political activities like get out the vote drives, voter mobilization efforts, those kinds of things that will enable them to perform their political role more effectively. So they have multiple sources of money, but it's primarily business income they get from their separate business operations that are usually tied to their membership and dues.
You were identifying other types of unions, such as airlines, construction, or the Hollywood Actors or Writers Guilds and what have you. It made me think of this question. Again, the question could be very broad and merit several hours of conversation. But generally speaking, how is UAW different than these other unions? Does it have a different flavor? Is there anything distinct about it in its history, you think?
Well, I think its history is, it's been historically considered a democratic union. And I don't want to get into the academic side of the debate over what's a democratic union, but generally it was considered to be one that listened to its membership, that protected its membership's right to participate in union affairs, and had leaders who operated with integrity. It's one of the first unions that came up with its own standard of ethics, which it built into its constitution in 1970. And it also had a review board, which provided a mechanism for hearing complaints of members if they felt that they were being mistreated by their union or union officers.
Was that very different than other unions?
They were, at the time of their formation, they were very unusual in the labor movement, and mm-hmm. they were really path-breaking. And I would say that generally it had a reputation for being a union of high integrity and innovative in its collective bargaining and its focus on getting as much as it could for its membership. And also it was considered to be very progressive at the front end of the civil rights movement, which differentiated it from some of the more traditional trade unions that was reluctant to some extent to embrace the full gamut of civil rights.
Yeah, yeah. Their reputation for high integrity becomes kind of a bit of an irony when you're talking about the last decade and this scandal that they had to go through.
That's why it was a very rude awakening, and it really blemished the union's reputation. And, you know, many people began to liken it to the Teamsters, but I would say that the Teamsters, used to put the Teamsters in comparison to the UAW in terms of their scandals. The Teamsters was mob infested. UAW was not. But both of them had this one thing in common. You know, when you have government oversight and you have a monitor appointed, they both had provisions in the consent decrees and in the government oversight that said there are certain groups of people that you are barred. If you're currently on the staff or an official of the union, you are barred from associating with or conducting business with as part of the union. And when they first listed that at the UAW, I think the list included about 15 to 20 people.
I see.
In the case of the Teamsters, it included over 700.
That's really funny. That's a great comparison, Dr. Masters.
Difference in magnitude here that we're talking about.
Exactly, difference of magnitude. In the minute we have left of this segment, I'm just wondering, recalling something from college education when I was studying European politics. I remember, now this is going into the 90s, I remember our college professor telling us about how, and he gave the example of the auto industry, how in Germany, union leaders actually sit with corporate heads of corporations and government leaders, and they make decisions about business. They had this, I don't know, what do they call it, trifecta or whatever, triangle, something like that.
It's a tripartite type of arrangement.
There you go. Did UAW or any other auto industry union, any other union in the U.S. ever reach that level of cooperation?
To a certain extent. They did have, and I believe they may still do, have a board representative on General Motors board.
Okay.
And they did at one point in time have a representative on the board of Chrysler. That was sort of a condition for getting the bailout in the 1970s. Just as an aside on that GM board representative they had from the UAW, one of the representatives at the time was somebody who took a good deal of money from the Joint Training Center.
Oh boy.
So, you know, when you retired from the UAW, you could get a board appointment, which he got. And it was, you know, they have a different type of arrangement which recognizes tripartite decision making. In the U.S., we've sort of called it corporatism. In which business and labor and government have had unofficial collaborative mechanisms to move an economic agenda, but it has not been operationalized anywhere near it has in European countries. We just have a much more different approach. And I would think one of the things that's clear about labor law, and this is a fundamental point, and I'd like to mention it in the context of the scandal that unions in the United States have to be financially independent of companies. Companies can't give any money to support union financial activities.
Okay.
And I always felt that the joint training centers, the way they operated, this is how they operated. The joint training centers would conduct training programs, and they were administered in joint training center buildings, which were built by the UAW, and the joint training centers are by the companies. And the UAW had offices in those training centers. And what ended up happening is that the UAW would loan their staff to the joint training centers, and the companies would pay for their staff.
Boy, service. That's starting to get muddy now.
It really is getting money. And yeah. In fact, when the courts intervened in this, they said that the UAW had to pay $15 million back to the companies for money that they took to subsidize their staff. And the investigation by the prosecutors found out that some of the staff weren't really doing anything for the joint training centers.
In Germany, where you have the tripartite mode of decision making, do companies give money to unions?
I don't think for council positions or board positions. Yeah. I think there's a little bit of a differentiation there. But board positions can be very lucrative. Mm-hmm. If you get a position, they can pay several hundred thousand dollars. Yeah.
We'll be back after a short break to talk about unions and U.S. presidents. We'll be right back. Hey there, News Peelers. We're working on a brand new website with many super-duper features, including videos of our guests and compilations of our episodes into series, with related blogs that are updated weekly, like series on U.S. politics, economy, health policies, environment, women's rights, and also series on many other countries, like Russia, Ukraine, China, and Brazil, and the British monarchy, and also a series on revolutions and protests, like those in Iran, Israel, and France. So be sure to check it out at historybehindnews.com. See you guys there. Dr. Masters, during the break, you told me a really interesting, I'll just use the word juicy, story about one of the people that was involved with this in the scandal that you were mentioning, and you wrote a book about it, and he owned a Lamborghini, and you happen to know this individual, right?
Well, yes. I had this individual was somebody who was a graduate of the university that I work with, and he held a high position at Chrysler, and we were so proud of him because of the high position that he held. He would have him come and talk to our students, and I would have him on my board, external advisory board, and I was surprised to read in the paper when his name was revealed as one of the prime targets of this investigation. And he ended up, he was the one that used the Joint Training Center funds to purchase the Lamborghini and also to refurbish his house.
Were you ever invited to his house?
No, I never did get an invitation to his house.
Did you ever see him pull up in the parking lot?
I never did see the Lamborghini. Okay. But it's my understanding that, you would think that if you use those funds to buy that, you would know that that probably wasn't the right thing to do. That wasn't what those funds were.
It's so conspicuous. People are going to say, where the heck is that coming from?
When you're driving it around with a personalized license plate, too, that really
exactly.
Is. That's almost like saying, putting a sign over your head, I'm corrupt, come and find me.
Exactly. So what happened to that former student of yours?
Well, he ended up spending some time in a federal penitentiary.
Did he have a family?
Yes, and that's the sad part.
Oh, I'm sorry for that. Yeah.
It was really, having your picture in the paper, your house photographed, and I'm certain that he wasn't an independently wealthy person. So, I don't know what happened to his family, whether they could support itself during this time period.
Yeah.
That's a tragedy.
That's the tragic part. We're talking about Lamborghinis. This should not be a segue to U.S. presidents, but somehow it is. It makes me think of him. In preparation for this conversation, one of the things that's really sort of fundamental that I thought about when I saw President Biden go and picket along UAW members, and I'm not getting into politics, let's put politics aside. What I was wondering is, where does the U.S. president get the authority? I'm not talking about a national mandate. I'm talking about, is there like a legal authority that a president can go and intervene in a strike? Because at the heart of it, isn't a strike a sort of a private contract between a company?
The bargaining between the parties under the National Labor Relations Act, they are private parties, not government entities. Even though they're publicly traded companies and the unions are nonprofit organizations, tax exempt, all that kind of stuff. But collective bargaining is considered a private matter in the private sector. But there are mechanisms under labor law, the National Labor Relations Act, for a president to intervene.
And
There are the Taft-Hartley provisions, and they allow for the president to declare a national emergency, to appoint a board to investigate the emergency and determine whether or not he should call a cooling off period of 80 days in which the parties have to go back to work and continue to negotiate a settlement. And the president has invoked this power on 37 occasions since the Taft-Hartley Act was passed in 1947.
37 occasions. Okay.
Yes. So there is a mechanism for direct involvement. Separate from that, presidents under the National Labor Relations Act have also gotten involved to a certain extent in jawboning. And that's in which they will call upon the parties to negotiate a settlement. For example, after the cooling off period, which was invoked by President Eisenhower in 1959 during the steel strike, you still didn't have a settlement after 80 days. And they were, the union was about ready to reject the contract that was agreed and go back out on strike. And nobody wanted that to happen after a very long strike involving 500,000 steel workers. It was an industry-wide strike. You had multiple companies bargaining with the same union. Richard Nixon was tasked by President Eisenhower to intervene and work out a settlement between.
So this is the late 1950s. Richard Nixon is the
1959. He was vice president. So he intervened and worked out a settlement between the companies and the union. In 1964, under the Railway Labor Act, President Johnson ran to avert a railway labor strike, brought the union together with the companies and in effect supervised the mediation of an agreement to prevent a strike from happening. So there have been in the times in which presidents have used their formal powers and used their informal powers. Mm-hmm. But Biden's trip to the picket line was the first time that a president had taken sides this public way. Before, in the midst of a dispute. And a lot of people have said that he really politicized the negotiations and shouldn't have done that. He got provoked the ire of the companies for doing this.
You think it'll backfire on UAW?
I would say it's very, very lukewarm. 75, I saw some opinion polls just the other day that 75% of the public supports the UAW. They don't blame the UAW. I think if the public blames anything, it probably blames some combination of corporate greed and also the electric vehicle policy mandates that they know are forcing the companies to be in a financial pinch.
Mm-hmm. In going to Detroit and picking along UAW members, do you think, I may have asked this question, I'll just ask it again in different words. Do you think the president helped the UAW cause? Or just unnecessarily publicized it?
I think he helped it in the sense that he certainly gave it an element of legitimacy.
Yeah.
And also, it is very meaningful to the people on the picket line and the workers on strike.
Of course.
Have the president come and convey his support. I think that helps energize them and give more confidence in what they're doing. And it puts the companies on the defensive.
Yeah.
And so I think from that standpoint, it's kind of like a shot in the arm. I don't believe it will materially affect the negotiations at this point, but I think it establishes a predicate for the president to get more involved should the strike become prolonged. And I think, many people say that, well, now he can't get involved because he's already shown he's biased. But I think
it
may just be the other way around, that since he's demonstrated his support from the union, and if the union's holding out for something that is, let's say, hypothetically not realistic, and the president wants his strike stopped for the benefit of the economy, he could go in and say, look, I support you, but now's the time to call this.
Oh, it gives him leverage the other way around. That's really interesting. He can tell to the unions, look, I'm pro-union. I came out there. I'm on your side. But you got to let a little bit here to come to a negotiation.
I think certainly both sides are going to listen to the president if he says, I think we ought to get together and talk about this and not let it drag on any longer. Hopefully it won't last that long.
Hopefully.
It's already lasted close to 3 weeks.
Yeah. Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Dr. Masters as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Dr. Masters, financially speaking, have labor unions helped auto workers in the last several decades? Let me, I should share the premise of my question with you. On the balance, while these strikes may have increased their wages and improved work conditions, has it created a situation in which jobs have become more scarce because now it's more expensive for companies to afford the labor?
Let me put it this way rather than casting blame, because anything the companies paid to the workers was agreed to by them with the union, even though the union may have been the ones pushing for it. Ultimately, the companies and the union bear responsibility. So therefore, I would say that when you analyze the situation, you can't help but to note that the companies found themselves with lopsided labor costs versus their competition. International competition, which is, they benchmarked themselves starting in the 1990s and then increasingly up to the Great Recession and then in the decade after that, to the foreign, so-called foreign transplants, those companies like Hyundai and Honda, Toyota, that operated plants in the U.S. And so they would compare.
And they're not unionized, right?
Yeah, and let's say in the year 2005, relatively speaking, around that time period, they would compare their labor costs across those groups. And among the Detroit Three, their hourly labor costs were over $72 an hour. Mm-hmm. In the foreign transplants, they were $45.
Wow, that's a big difference.
And so the costs became prohibitive, and the companies also had overcapacity. Their market share was declining, and they weren't producing as many cars. And so they had too many plants. They paid their workers too much in the way of benefits, particularly. They had huge liabilities on their balance sheets for pensions and retiree health care that they had to get rid of to make themselves competitive. And so they went through a painful downsizing of reducing their footprint, eliminating plants, restructuring, siphoning off their some of their parts producers, such as Delphi.
I remember that, yeah.
And also they had to eliminate retiree health care, eliminate defined benefit pension plans, eliminate the so-called jobs bank, which paid workers basically to be unemployed at the off the company dime, and also to eliminate the cost of living allowance. So they did all those things.
And GM and Delphi also, I think, both filed for bankruptcy. That was 2006. Yes. Yeah.
And then GM in 2009, and also Chrysler filed for bankruptcy in 2009, and they both got government subsidies before then. And so they were in a situation where they had to do major restructuring, get rid of a lot of dealerships, downsize. And so you could say their labor costs are one of the things that caused them to have to shed jobs. But the companies also had built up overcapacity and hired too many workers that they didn't need. And they were that's why they were laying them off and had to have jobs banks. And so once the economy turned south, and it began to happen in the auto industry before the Great Recession, in which the sales of the companies plummeted, and the companies were in financial hardship before the recession. The recession magnified that, and they had to make further cutbacks, make further concessions in contracts, and basically put themselves on a austerity path for several years that the union is trying to catch up with now.
So in this case, it seems like the high wages that union members were paid actually worked against them in that their jobs dwindled, right? And
well, I would put it the high compensation, because they had not only higher wages, but you know, the companies, the foreign transplants and others, knew they had to pay their workers a decent wage to avoid a union. But what they didn't have were the health care, retiree health care liabilities. They didn't have the defined benefit pension liabilities. And their health care costs weren't as much because their plans were not as gold-plated. And also, their workforces were younger. Mm-hmm. And health.
Interesting.
That may all in the world.
Have there been any in the previous segment? I said we're not going to get into politics. I guess this relates to politics. You know, the right is against unions. Well, sometimes they're for it, as President Trump visited UAW last week. But we usually look at unions as something that is supported by the left, generally speaking. So I'm wondering, so this is an interesting topic. I'm wondering if there have been any academic studies to weigh whether or not on the balance unions have been good for any particular industry. I don't even know how you could sort of put that on a scale.
Well, certainly there have been a lot of studies that have addressed union effects. Studies have addressed union effects on wages. Studies have addressed union effects on productivity and on profitability, including unit labor costs. I would say that the mix of the results is that unions obviously raise wages. They may diminish profitability.
Yeah.
They may increase productivity in selected instances because they hire better trained workers who are more carefully controlled by work rules and management policies than you may have in more non-union situations that in which management may not be held to as high of health and safety standards and training standards as they are in the unionized sector.
So that is a mixed result. As we close our conversation, you're there in Detroit, so I wanted to get an eyewitness perspective. First, have you been involved in these negotiations?
No.
You have not?
No.
No, okay. Were you going to add something qualified?
Well, I was going to say I have been among manufacturing firms. I have been involved in high-level negotiations. and seeing what goes on behind the scenes. But
ever since with the UAWA?
Since I came here, in 2009, when I headed a program called Labor at Wayne, which included the Doug Fraser Center for Workplace Issues, and Doug Fraser is a former UAW president, I had both labor and management on my board, and I've deliberately tried to not get involved in consulting with any kind of personal benefit for me, either party, because I want to be objective. As I comment in the media on this, I don't want to be in a position where I would feel like it wouldn't be right for me to go out and comment publicly about these situations if I were being paid by one of the parties.
Of course. Yeah, that makes sense. Is this strike a big deal in Detroit?
Yes, you can't get away from it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's still a auto industry dominated town, so to speak. And
dominate the town.
Yeah, yeah. There, you still have people it's still the Motor City. People focus on cars, the car industry, the big three, and the UAW. So those are iconic institutions that play a very large role, larger-than-life role in this metropolitan area.
Dr. Masters, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so much, Dr. Masters.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past, rather is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.